Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
I'm feeling like I want to dance.
Really?
Yes.
You feel like that a lot though, don't you?
No, I don't actually. But sometimes the mood does come over me. And and I would love to dance. And I'm inspired because today's guest creates incredible performances. And I've actually read that she likes to dance, which is, I think, one of the kind of impulses which led to her performances. We will discover very soon. But also, one of the reasons you and I fell in love with our guest's work is because she also makes vessels and ceramics and kind of very much linked to the history of pottery. And they kind of have their own personalities. And you and I have been obsessed with ceramics, especially ceramics within contemporary art, within that kind of context for a long time now.
Yes.
And our guest has an amazing exhibition, which you've seen. And unfortunately, I haven't, because I'm sadly stuck in Kent, still sort of being very careful. But I know that you went the other day, didn't you, in London?
Yeah, as soon as the galleries were opened in London, I got the message and I was straight down there on my bike. To a gallery called Corvimora, which is a former guest of Talk Art, Tommaso Corvimora. And I saw the show and I said to Tommaso, we have to get this artist on Talk Art. This is amazing. And here we are. So it's happy days.
And the show is called Neighbourhood Garden. Love that title. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art, Shawanda Corbett.
Hi,
Shawanda.
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Where in the world are you, Shawanda?
I am in Oxford.
In England?
In England, yeah.
Yes. And people listening to your accent would think you're in America. You've been in the UK for a few years now, right?
Yeah, a few years, yeah.
When did you first come here?
It was back in 2016 for my master's.
And that was at the Ruskin?
At the Ruskin, yeah.
Yeah.
And why did you choose the Ruskin? What was it about the Ruskin that took you from New York to Oxford?
Well, one of the many things that I really liked about the Ruskin was I am able to really be open, free-flowing, you know, because the States, their curriculum is taking other courses while you're practicing art, and here is not like that. You are free to move about and you know, expand in many different ways, but it's not a requirement to take other courses on top of your main course. And I like to be quite free with my work because I work well when I am not instructed to do things. So I'm pretty much kind of a rebel. So those type of structures never worked well for me because I still just venture off and do my own thing, which is kind of what the Ruskin definitely nurture and really push students to do, is to be very independent in their own studies.
Right.
Yeah.
Was there anyone that you knew from the Ruskin that who had graduated that you kind of looked to as a role model for that course?
No, the course was actually quite new. It's in its, I want to say, second year. Oh, right. So, yeah, it was really new. It's a really new program. So I didn't know anyone.
But you have got an amazing tutor there who me and Rob and the rest of the world are obsessed with, the artist Lynette Yaidenbiachi, who is your tutor, and she has been an incredible champion for you. What has that been like, being taught by Lynette?
Oh, man, Miss Lynette, which is like a Southern thing when you call someone by, you know, Miss or Mister. So Miss Lynette, yeah. I refer to her as Miss Lynette. So she's been very great. Like, she's just in conversation, really challenge how I see things, and her being a painter, really loved her work before getting there. So the fact that I was assigned to her, I was really excited and a little nervous. So mm-hmm. Her mind is so, it's just so, I guess, flexible. I want to say flexible. And it's not just painting. She sees things very three-dimensional, which is very, very helpful coming from ceramics, studying ceramics for so long. And so I was able to really talk to her. Even when I wanted to switch over to performance, I wanted to get rid of ceramics, and she challenged me with that, like, if you give me a good reason to quit ceramics, then, you know, then it's fine. She really encouraged me to hold on to that as well. So that was really great. Yeah, it was really good that she kind of convinced me to stay with it. But to also, like, apply those ceramic principles to other mediums as well. So yeah, right. Yeah, she's been very, very great.
So did you experience a kind of fatigue with the idea of making ceramics and continuing to make ceramics after you've been doing it for such a long time? Because you've been making them for maybe more than 10 years now.
Yeah. So I felt like I did felt a bit of a fatigue from it, because when you are learning about ceramics in academia, it is ceramics all day, every day. And it's history, right. And, you know, the chemistry, which I love, but just sitting at the wheel, because I was taught in a production potter format to mm-hmm. produce a lot consistently. So I needed to find a way to break that and to actually enjoy it. Different ways, you know, bring in painting and other things, so it can be like a transaction between different mediums. Yeah,
right.
Well, you've actually worked out a bespoke way of a throwing technique using the potter's wheel, right?
Yeah. So with that, starting out, yeah. I was terrible. Okay, like the clay would fly off the wheel, frustrated. But because you're quite taught to use two hands, and I only have one, so and it was actually a conversation with I think it was a mathematician at one of the colleges that I studied at. And we were talking about calculus and sine, cosine, tangent. And he was like, actually, you know, with the centrifugal force, you can just use one, you know, one sided pressure to throw. And I was like, there's no way. And then he sort of showed me mathematically. I'm like, oh, okay. So that really encouraged me to look in different cultures and how they throw and things like that. And I came across Japanese pottery and how sometimes they do throw upside down, which was very helpful. Very helpful.
Right. What does that mean? Like, so there's like one point of pressure on, so you don't need both hands. You can do it with one hand, one point.
One hand.
Well, what do you mean upside down? What does that mean?
Upside down means like the form is you throwing the form upside down. So the foot comes first, not the neck or the lip. Yeah. So you throw the foot first.
So how do you keep it hollow inside with that? How does that technique work?
Oh, is you just know,
like if you turn it up then and you put... Yeah, go on, sorry.
Oh, yeah. So you can either close it off on the bottom, but it's all just thrown like you would throw a cylinder. You know, it's the same process. Yeah. It's just flipped. Yeah.
Hmm. Wow. I love that. And you've looked at a lot of techniques. You just mentioned the Japanese wheel throwing, but you've looked at like African vessels and Middle Eastern like utilitarian vessels and Egyptian glass. And it feels like your development has been inspired by several different cultures.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Not just how they make, but how they think about making, you know, how they see form. You know, I don't just really see how they make things, like their actual process is also like the culture around it, because there's a complete culture and history around it, and it changes with how the environment and how the community has changed. So that changes, whether it's within subtleties in the surface or the form or just how it's presented, you know. And so you can kind of eyeball and see like what era that actually came from. Just thinking about, you know, being knowledgeable about their how they just spoke, how they communicated, how they, you know, what other cultures they've been in contact with. It all changes.
Yeah. And these ceramics we're talking about that you've made for this show, Neighborhood Garden, which is currently on at Corvin Mora Gallery, these are almost, well, I'd say they're kind of like toddler size. I would say life size, toddler size. They're up to like, you know, they're a few feet tall, aren't they? And these are massive vessels. And at the minute, they're in the middle of the room on a big platform. And they're in pairs. And they are, you said, described them as being figurative as well as vessels. They actually have personalities. They are people that you've experienced in your life.
Actually, with funny thing, like the vessels are quite my eye level without my chair. So I make things that are from my perspective. Always, you know, make an effort for that. So for me, they're like, you know, they're quite life size for me. But for other people, it's that. So if you do see it, you kind of have to kneel down, and it's kind of, and it really overlaps the paintings as well that's within the show. And so it gives you a different perspective of the vessels or person.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that's how you would you like to want people to do that and see that as kind of the way to experience the work?
You know, I do. I mean, you know, it's not a requirement, but but it's just, you want to just a little bit something extra. Yeah, just get eye level with the vessels.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I really love the way that some of them tilt as well, because they kind of have their own character, and you feel like that they're almost like how they come to be is, you know, while you're making them, rather than, like you mentioned earlier, that idea of having to consistently make something that's kind of accurately, you know, identical each time. You know, if you're making, I don't know, say
like
a
commercial,
bowl. Commercially. Yeah. And there's a rule kind of in the history of ceramics that you have to make them all in a certain way, and they have to. But what I like about yours is that you are breaking the rules. Like you described yourself as a rebel earlier, which I loved. I was like, ding, ding, ding. But I really like that in the work, this kind of the way they tilt and they have this kind of quirky, like, you know, individuality.
Individual bodies, don't they? Yeah.
I think within that and throwing, it really starts within throwing, because each ball or bag of clay has its own memory. So I just let the clay form into whatever form it wants to be, instead of forcing it.
I love that. Hang on, let's go back over that again. So you mean the clay from the earth has its own life force?
Yeah, it does. It has its own.
Isn't that
quite a Japanese, like you're releasing
kind of,
it?
Yeah.
Isn't that quite a Japanese like way of thinking?
Yes, it's a very Japanese way of thinking. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's new energy. It's the energy that you're transferring energy and you're like the conduit to the new version of that energy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So like, yeah, so I just, it's very much a meditative state. So it's just me responding to the clay. So when it, and because the bottom and certain sections are thrown either right side up or upside down, it kind of unwinds when it's fired. So when it dries, it unwinds a little bit because each part is thrown in different directions. So it allows it to tilt or sag or do whatever it naturally does with the how the air is moving within the space during its drying state. Yeah.
Wow. And was that something that you developed through your connection to the Japanese potter Kazuya Ishida?
Yes. He was amazing.
He sounds amazing.
Yeah. So like listen to him talk. And he was talking about how they don't necessarily plan out how the forms will look. He would just let it happen. And he really challenged me to do the same. And I've never looked back since then. So it's just, yeah.
So it changed the work. He changed your thinking behind it all.
Yeah, it definitely changed the work for sure. And thinking.
So these works were all based on moments in time of your childhood in Mississippi and then in New York. And they're all based on people in your neighborhood, like Neighborhood Garden. Mm-hmm. They're all based on your community, right?
Yeah, yeah. Many different people. You know, in every community that I lived in, they have one particular person that does something like Candy Lady. I've had a Candy Lady in every community that I lived in growing up. So it's just like the embodying
what
of
is
all
a
those.
What's a Candy Lady?
Okay, so like a Candy Lady is a person, a woman is usually typically a woman within the community that sold like candy and chips and things like that to children or to well to anyone within the neighborhood for a very low price. So if you like go to a corner store, it would cost significantly much more. So the Candy Lady would do it at discounted prices.
And that and you would experience them in every community you've been in. That's an American culture thing, is it?
I don't know. Like I want to say it's more of a Black community culture.
Right, right.
Because I haven't heard of anything like that in other communities.
No.
Yeah.
I can think of it here being like the ice cream van man or something.
Yeah.
It's like they come round in the community and you get your 99 flake from them.
Yeah.
I guess. But I love the titles you got. It's a Candy Lady. But then there's another one I saw called Neighborhood Crackhead.
Yeah.
So I guess that's the same as Candy Lady, but with crack.
Yeah.
Is that the...
Yeah.
Is that the same?
No. No. That is actually just a person.
Oh, right.
That was at one point on drugs, but it was more about that person's personality. You know, it's kind of like a stigma within Black communities, within media, of how a typical person, like they're dangerous and things like that. And in my experience, and I can't speak for everyone else, that they've done things and made choices on how to process life and how to do things like that, but they're actually really good people. And, you know, they're actually really kind. It's just how they cope with the world. And so I wanted to really focus on that person's personality and the positive things that they have, given within their communities. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so true because it's so easy to sort of vilify, you know, people who are addicted to drugs or different things, but actually they're still
humans. To write
them
off, isn't it? You write them off as that's
what they are. Yeah, exactly. I've seen it a lot here, actually, in Kent where I live. You get to know, it's a very small community here and you do get to know a few people. And I agree. I mean, they just seem like very normal, kind people who are sadly addicted to whatever substance it is. But it doesn't mean that they're, you know, not kind.
Less than.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you find art, Shawanda? How did you get into art?
Well, it's always been around in my household. My mother painted a lot during my childhood, you know, because she grew up in Brooklyn. And so at one point you have to choose which path you wanted to go down. And she went down art. So she's like really good in drawing and painting. And we always had books with artists in it. That's all we had. So I would read upon it and things like that. And we got into music, classical, blues, jazz, all of that, always playing in the house and you know, and watching my father because he's a welder. So we were around it all the time, all the time.
Wow.
Yeah.
And listen, and jazz is a huge part of your practice now because you listen to different jazz songs when you're creating work, right?
Yeah, listen to jazz, love it.
And you use that while you're working and that energy goes into the pieces?
Yeah, yeah.
It makes me think of Stanley Whitney makes paintings. Do you know Stanley Whitney's work? And all of his paintings are based on like jazz music scores.
Yes, yes. I was exposed to it a few years ago and really thought that was great and fantastic. And I started introducing that into my making process. So listen to jazz or any kind of music, but I mostly listen to jazz.
What's your favorite sort of jazz musicians?
Oh man, there's so many.
if you can give us like top three or something.
Top three, man.
I'm challenging you now.
Okay. Eric Dolphy. He's great. Mm. Eric Dolphy.
Okay.
Charles Mingus.
Is he contemporary?
He was, kind of, sort of. He was around at the same time with John Coltrane.
Train,
yep. Yeah, which John Coltrane is my third one. But his wife, Alice Coltrane, she's amazing with a harp. She's great. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
All right, that's good
and
to know.
And Eric Dolphy was a saxophonist.
Yeah, Eric Dolphy, I think it's because he plays so many different instruments. There was one particular song that really got me hooked, and it's called Springtime. And I think he was playing the bassoon in this one. And it's just beautiful, just beautiful.
Wow. Do you
so
play
who was your second one?
The second one was Charles Mingus.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Do you play any instruments or sing? Do you sing?
I play the trumpet a little bit. I'm not like, you know.
You're not a genius.
Right. I do all right.
That's cool. Because as you said in the intro, you love dancing. And there's been a couple of performances that you can actually see online, one on the Serpentine website. Mm-hmm. Called Blackbird, Mississippi, which you did in 2019, where there is music, there's beautiful singing, and there's a performance that you gave. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. So I really wanted to, I guess, create an environment of how I move about, you know, giving my my background, my family background is in Mississippi on both sides. So what I really wanted to do was bring a lot of the culture in Black communities from Mississippi and bring it there and create it there for that moment in time. And so there was singing and musicians and dancing, which is very much part of the Christian community as well. So, yeah, so I wanted to, there's this, this ministry called Mime Ministry, which mime dance been around for like a very, very, very long time. But the way they use it and how they very much influenced by African dance and things like that. And so I wanted to bring that there. And, you know, so I very much collaborated with my younger brother, and he's a trained dancer and choreographer.
It's Albert Corbett, right?
Yeah. So yeah. He choreographed the first dance piece that I did, and the second one was improv. So the first one, he wanted to do, you know, very, you know, like the Mississippi way of dancing. You have to be very vulnerable, really connected. As he would say, you have to do things with your body that is humanly impossible to show them that you are human. And so we really talked about like church, but without using songs from you know, church songs. Not really church songs, but it's like maybe a few are like Negro spirituals, but I wanted to really do that with the singers, and that's the main thing about mime, you know, is you're telling a story to people who couldn't read, you know, historically, you're giving them the information through movement, and it's a language, you know, and so that's why I really collaborated with the gospel group in London. Yeah. They're amazing.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah.
Beautiful, like, you know, and the way I always format it, I do all the thinking, the research, and the writing, and so all they have to do is come in and just do their part, which was really great because it seems like, and it looks like we rehearsed for months, and it was just that
collaborate together. Yeah,
it's all about collaboration. Wow. So we only got together that week, the week of the performance, and it worked out. So
and it was one performance.
Yeah, it was one.
Would you do it again somewhere? Is that something you'd like to take around? Because you create this the stage as well, like a platform. I've seen one where you've put the platform together and then you've used that as a stage, and especially in the show Neighborhood Garden, there's a platform which you was meant to use for the opening, but COVID stopped that from happening. But it's a thing where you can travel around, right?
Mm-hmm. It's something that can easily be broken down and installed, and you know what I mean, but it, you know, with every performance, which is a little bit with the Japanese way of making, is that it's going to be different because it's all about using everyone's energy. You know what I mean? It's that energy, releasing energy. So it all depends on the audience. And because the format is in a circular format for everyone to sit. So it's a continuous thing, you know. It's just how to ground everyone, how to connect with everyone by certain things, certain characteristics. And that's what I think about, on how can we all connect? Even though I'm talking about my own background, but how can we all connect? Yeah.
And actually, you were inspired by Pina Bausch, no? The German...
Pina Bausch. But also, Catherine Dunham. She's another one.
Ah.
Her as well.
Right.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah.
But, and no, theatre, I mean, in general... Theatre mm-hmm. is like a big thing for you.
Yeah. Love theatre. Yeah, I think it's because of being, you know, doing, you know, being fascinated by different people growing up. And when I think it was just how we all within that community talk. We take on that person's personality and say it exactly the way they would say it, and different characteristics, and we will move different, and we would like either we slouch forward or, you know, just whatever. And so, and because I really love dance, and with Pina Bausch, she was all about breaking down ballet and, you know, getting away from that. And it's all about how the body just moves and really letting go, and which I really, really loved. And her presentation of it is phenomenal. So, I wanted to bring that in.
And also collaborating with your brother, mm-hmm. I heard you describe it before as being this kind of great connection with him, because he was very familiar with how you personally actually move. And that as many choreographers, they kind of get stuck in their way of seeing dance because of body type. And, you know, if you are a differently abled person, like to have someone who's sort of grown up with you, who actually understands you, like that means you're probably going to get to an even more enlightened kind of state of performance somehow. So is that connection very special for you?
Oh, yeah, very special. You know, there, even within his group of friends that are dancers, they process it the same, ironically, and mm-hmm. I've never met them, but they process movement and things like that. It's just a series of lines. That's how they break it down. That's how they just boil all the way down to, it's just a series of lines, shapes, how your body moves. And so, so it was really great to work and see his friends dance and use their bodies in so many different ways. But also, like, because you have choreographers who do teach other people with different body types, but, you know, they're kind of stuck in that traditional way of being taught in ballet or and even in contemporary as well. It was really great to see and to experience that with someone who isn't so tied down to that, is taught, mm-hmm. you know, traditionally, but think differently, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So, so it's just like just finding different ways to dance, and that's when Catherine Dunham came in, because she danced all the way until like she wasn't able to like stand or things like that. She was in a wheelchair and she still danced. Mm-hmm. So that really really inspired me to keep going, and because her technique is all about isolation of each body part and moving it to, you know, as many different possibilities you can think of and not think of, and just like move on, you know. And that's where I really started with that, actually practicing on my own, was through the Catherine Dunham technique.
Amazing.
Wow. It feels like you're really challenging the perception of what an artist with a physical disability is like expected to do. It's like you're really like opening it up, you're blasting it out of the water. You're not allowing perceptions to stop you from creating.
Yeah, and I think I really give all that to my parents, because I wasn't raised to think that way of what, because around that time, you know, there was a different cultural, society, you know, thought about the disability community and children and things like that, and what they should do, mm-hmm. you know, what, and you're just making their limitations up for them, you know, without them actually exploring. So for me, I didn't know there were easier ways of going about doing things like physically, like, cause I loved sports, but I didn't know there was like an adaptive, you know, sports for, you know, and to find that out in adulthood, I'm like, man, that could have been like an easier way of going about this, playing basketball without a chair. But like, okay. But you know, but it was a good lesson within that, you know, of not thinking, you know, what is society's limitations of you, you know, and to, just to really push myself and continue to even challenge my own thoughts about what my abilities are. Yeah.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I was really interested in this idea of the complete body and like what is a complete body, and also the way that you've kind of been analyzing, you know, like disability theory mm-hmm. and kind of looking at cyborg theory and this whole idea of cyborgs and AI and machinery.
Yeah.
Can you speak a bit about that and the 1985 manifesto that you have kind of tried to adapt to make it more current?
Yeah. I really liked the Cyborg Manifesto by Donna Haraway. But one thing I noticed, it was a lot of, you know, terminology that is very, very trans, very LGBTQ, very disability terminology that it has been used in the medical field to describe disabled bodies. And but it was mm-hmm. was to talk about you know, women, but you know, you know, there's a certain group of women that she's really talking about, because it's her perspective, and there's nothing wrong with that mm-hmm. but what I wanted to do was to, you know, like you what you see in science fiction, you know, and in like sci-fi movies and things like that, and they're always talking about like things being added, machinery being added to the body to make it better, you know, and, you know, and it's just like, well, you know, I kind of live that. I've done prosthetics before. I've done, you know, I have a, you know, wheelchair and things like that. And it's talking about something.
And the potter's wheel, I guess, is like an extension, isn't it? Of something you're using.
Yeah. It's just anything that's mechanical that enhances your life is cyborg. So, and it was when I was watching, I want to say, I'm trying to think about this science fiction movie that came out in the 60s. I'll get back to it. It'll come to me. But I was thinking about, you know, well, these things that they're talking about and imagining, they're actual people that actually live these lives. And so what is that like in reality? And so it gave me a more realistic way of thinking about that. So, you know, and so it's just like, I don't really subscribe to disability theory, because it's all, you know, social, political things that is, again, being decided not by the community, but for the community by people who are able-bodied, you know? So cyborg seems more realistic for me, you know, because, you know, I use different components that works, you know, functions just fine by itself. But if you put it together, it functions even more, you know, better, more flexible and things. Yeah. So,
right.
Which is,
is that a movement as well, a cyborg community? Is that like
thing? Yeah, it is.
Wow.
It is. You know, there is, there are cyborg writers from like, I want to say the 90s. There was like a series, writing series, which is quite nice if you can find it. It's a movement, you know, and a lot of that came from the Bauhaus movement. which is like well documented. And I love Bauhaus. Love it. So it was like you have whatever concept and you have the physical ability to apply that theory within any medium you want to, which is kind of how my practice is set up right now. And especially with Oscar Schlemmer's ballet, which is very, you know, different cyborgs, and it's all about their movement, and it's a very political piece, So, and I just fell in love with that because it was the form. It was like changing the changing the movement of the body with wearable architecture or costumes and things like that kind of dictate how the body would move. And I really like that, being able to control it in that way and to get that type of movement with every dancer. So,
In your Serpentine performance, which was titled Blackbird in Mississippi, you applied the white porcelain slip to your face. Yeah. Was it just your face? Yeah. And then as the performance goes on, it kind of starts to dry and crack and evolve like on the surface of your skin. Can you speak like a bit about that? Because I found that so it's incredible, the link in a way to the... I know ceramics. It's obviously literally linked, but also, I don't know, after seeing the performance, I see your ceramics in such a different way.
So I really, you know, like within the mime dance ministry, they use paint, face paint, but I wanted something different. So I tried it with slip casting. Porcelain. So there's no like no chemicals and things like that in it. But I liked how at first it makes you look very stoic and it enhances the facial features even more as I move and things like that. And always I've always thought about like how slip is on ceramics. Because it has to be compatible. You can't just use any type of slip for every, you know, clay body. So sometimes it isn't compatible, so it flakes off, it cracks off, and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so I know with my face, and I kind of explore with different types of casting slips. Because if it's porcelain, then it's just, it really stays on. But you have add something different to it, it kind of rejects the face, it falls off, and it's easily rubbed off. So it all depends on how the thickness and, you know, how thick I apply it, how thin I apply it. And what I wanted to really enhance is how, you know, my face, you know, like the different facial expressions, how I respond to certain person in the audience that I'm making contact with, you know, and it's a very, it's like a, like an undoing, but in a way, like how every ball of clay have its own memory, your body has its own memory. And it's like releasing that memory and that energy and things like that.
Wow. Did you want to do, what were you going to do at the show at Corvimora? Which, by the way, we have to say congratulations because you've completely sold out.
Thank you.
There's a whole sequence of drawings, a whole platform of ceramics. It's the most beautiful show. What does that feel like to have your debut show there and B, to have it sold out? But also, what was you planning for the opening night?
You know, I am really happy that it... to have the show sold out, but you know, but more importantly, you know, I am very overwhelmed in a very good way of how, you know, how it was so positively received and being able to reach other people, you know, and it's like it's kind of like being heard, you know, and you know, your mm-hmm. your perspective is being heard and received, and that's you know, that's very you know, just that and you know, alone is enough for me. But for the opening, I planned a performance called Breathe. And Breathe, the performance, actually came from a conversation that I had with my nephew like last year. And he was in middle mm-hmm. school and he was in football, really good at it. And he, you know, American football. So he told me that he didn't want to do it anymore. And I said, well, why? He's like, well, in football, you know, the football players become bulky and big, and he didn't want to seem like a threat to the police. So,
Oh my God.
To hear him say that, and he's just a kid, you know, so that really affected me. So I wanted to, you know, bring that conversation into a space. How, you know, it's, you know, and I broke it all the way down to just the breath, you know, because it's something that we all need to live. And so, so I, you know, used a person who plays a French horn and another and his sister that plays the flute and, you know, and someone that's playing the piano. And it was, and it's all, you know, based off of this this composer, William Grant Still. And he made work, composed music about the African-American experience. It was about like early 1900s. So I wanted to do something similar to that. So I planned it on having my brother and my brother's best friend to come and dance. And we're all from Mississippi. So, well, he's from Alabama, but like 30 minutes away. So it's kind of the same, a little bit. So so have them really come and dance for everyone. And I dance with...
Will you do it at some other point then? Will you do, will
I'm
you get
hoping
to do this
so.
Again, at the end of the run.
Yeah, I'm hoping so. Hoping. Yeah, but it's, yeah, it's very, it's classical, but I turned it into something that is jazz. So it's, yeah, it's really about the breath, the breath, the breath within the instruments.
Has your nephew changed his mind?
He has not. He has not. Especially,
especially
with things that are going on now within the States.
It's like a whole other.
Yeah, so I've been really pushing for something that is, you know, something that is telling and something that is healing for anyone who has felt that in their own communities, you know. So, so it's been. So that, you know, with my nephew, that was definitely heartbreaking. It was definitely started off from that conversation.
Wow. What's it been like for you as an American in the UK coming here? Like culturally, have you found it bizarre?
It's so different because I'm loud. You know, I'm very much in your face. You know, and I thought I was quite quiet and you know, very chill. Nah, not coming here.
Especially Oxford as well. It's not like you're coming to London. You're going to Oxford. It's like...
like everyone's so poised. And I'm like, yeah, no, I'm not that, you know, because, you know, every once in a while, that country accent slips out and, you know, I get really loud, you know, and sometimes it's a little bit daunting for some people. I'm like, oh, okay, well, no, too much energy. Okay, I'll dial it back. Maybe a little bit. Probably not.
Yeah, don't. Totally.
So,
congratulations for us is for the Soul Act show. But the second congratulations, which has only been announced in the last couple of days, is the fact that you were awarded, won the Turner Prize from the Tate, £10,000 because we couldn't have the Turner Prize nominations this year, so they selected 10 people, and you were one of the 10 people that were selected.
Yeah.
Huge.
Yeah.
Huge. What's that like? And did you know that was coming? And was this something you had to submit stuff or?
No, I had no idea. I had no idea. You know, I submit nothing. I, you know, wasn't really thinking about that, but Tate contacted me about it, and I was like, oh, yeah. Absolutely.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
I guess that must also make you feel like, you know, you're connecting, you know, with what you're doing, because what you're putting out into the world is bringing, you know, things that you haven't even applied for. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's sort of these waves that go out of energy and then it's coming back to you. So that's a really beautiful thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you look at other ceramicists? Do you look at anyone else? Like, we had Grayson Perry on. Is he someone you're looking to at all? And is there other like ceramicists, like post-war ceramicists and stuff that you think are incredible?
Ah, oh, man. Magdalene Adundo.
Yes.
Yes. She is
love.
My
them
all
forms
time.
Are incredible.
Incredible. I saw her. It was like the ceramics conference.
The Hepworth Wakefield, wasn't it? Where was it? She had a show. Was it the Hepworth Wakefield?
I think yes. I think
so. Was it Rob?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I didn't see that.
Yeah.
Where did you see the show?
It wasn't a show. She. It was. I think it was like maybe 2010, 2011. She came to Alabama to a clay conference, and she gave a speech, a lecture in a museum in Birmingham, Alabama. And I was there, and I was like, yes. This was the first time I even saw her work and hear her speak about a work, and just fell in love with it completely.
Yes, she was in. I'm just looking up now. Magdalene Adundo was at the Journey of Things at the Hepworth Wakefield. The exhibition brings together more than 50 of Adundo's vessels. Yes, Guardian gave it 5 stars. Kenyan-born Magdalene Adundo, OBE, is one of the world's most esteemed ceramic artists. Good one. That's a lovely person to look up to.
Yeah, yeah, she's great. I just love her work. Love her work and how she speaks about it.
Amazing.
Can we talk about a series of work that Tommaso just showed me recently, which was earlier, I think, than the show you've just put on, which is a series called Black Bodies in Camouflage. And I found those works so interesting because you actually used transfer on the ceramics, because a lot of your current works have like gold
luster.
Luster.
And then gold luster, and then also obviously painted elements. But I was really into these transfer works.
You know, in ceramics, image transfer is only for like just one pass through screen prints, like one layer, and they're patterns, and you know, and I worked with the printmaking professor here, Graham Hughes, and we kind of turned it into an actual full printing, but we had to think backwards. Like, cause you're so whatever is stuck to the paper, that's the image that's going to be shown. So I had to retrain my brain on how to think backwards with that. And so what I wanted to do, with that, I was very influenced by William Morris. So I really took some of his patterns, very close in shots of his patterns, prints and things like that, and turned them into images and deconstruct them on the form. Yeah. So I really love image transfer. It's very easy to do. I got that from a ceramic artist that was in North Carolina at the time. Mm-hmm. And I went to this place called Pinland School of Craft, and which is like in the mountains, like on top of a mountain, I think. And it's like it's all different craft forms, and it's like kind of like a campus a little bit. And so you know, you have like your ceramics, you have your metals, your printmaking, just everything, your glass blowers. And so this guy named Jason Burnett, he does image transfer, and he showed us how to do it with underglaze. And that was, I thought that was like magic. I was very fortunate to see how he did things, but also being able to turn it into something that is mine within my own practice. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And your works on paper, the patterns from those, I've read that they may appear, or you consider them to appear in the ceramics at a later stage.
I was thinking about it. You know, just keep it going, because you know there are beginning stages of the ceramics.
So, what's next for Shawanda? What's going on next?
What's next? Starting the process all over, different. You know, reading and things like that. But I had said yes to a show in Austria and I think it's in September to contribute 5 works. So some of those vessels are going to be from the paintings from the show.
Oh,
and great. And that is named The Black Saint and the Black Saint and the Sinner Lady, and that is based off of the album, you know, of Charles Mingus, which is great because he made music about, you know, dancers. But what that is really about is about Black women and Black trans women, you know, because you know they were very important in my life growing up. So. And, you know, it's just really much a response to what's been going on in the States again. And to really talk about that womanhood process and things like that.
So you grew up with black trans women that were like
in
your life?
Yeah, yeah. So in New York, in Long Island, my grandmother, all her friends were gay men, drag queens and trans women. So that's, you know, that was really huge part of my life. I stayed with her for.
She sounds amazing. I love her.
Yes.
What an icon. What an amazing experience to grow up with. So that was your grandmother. That's so
exciting.
Yeah,
it was my grandmother. So like every Saturday they would have them, she would have them over and they would like listen to blues and just cackle and drink and things like that. And it was just,
And you were exposed to that at a really early stage in your formative years?
Yeah, it was like eight or nine. Yeah.
Oh my God, you should write a book about your grandmother.
She's great. She was great. Yeah. So she had her environment that she had for us. And, and we accepted them, everyone, for who they were, who they are, you know.
She must have gone through a lot with her friendship group then, I guess, when the 80s and the 90s, when the AIDS epidemic kicked in. I bet that must have really affected kind of what was going on for her.
Yes. I've heard stories of her, when she did live in New York City, and her friends, some of her friends were part of the drag show, house, you know, like the house with the mothers and things like that.
Drag
like
houses, the balls and everything.
Yeah, the balls and things like that, you know. And so she, you know, when the AIDS, HIV, you know, that hit, she has lost a lot of friends. She lost a lot of friends through that. So just hearing her talk about the different people and how she tells the story, she would definitely take on their personality and things like that. And so it was phenomenal to hear them all talk about it. Yeah.
Wow.
What was your grandmother's name, Shawanda?
Mary Bell. She went by Mary Bells. Mary Bells. That was her name.
That is We'll have to like, I don't know if it's, we can name a drag queen Mary Burris as like in as like ultimate respect. It's like, yeah. It's like, that'd be great.
Oh my God, you should do it in your show, Ross.
I know. God.
Can I quickly ask something before we move on to the final section of the show? You know, we were talking about your drawings earlier. I've been looking at them so much because I'm obsessed with them. I mean, I thought they were kind of like paintings on paper. How do you actually describe them? And what do the patterns, do they actually represent anything? Because to me, they felt like almost like codes or maps to like
or aerial views
or something.
Of,
yeah, because
I
feel like if you follow the map, you might end up finding the doorway to something or something. I don't know.
Like
I felt
it's like
they're very intriguing.
Some Inca pyramid or something like, and if you just like 3D version.
I'm obsessed.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed with
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Well, I see them as paintings on paper. Mm-hmm. But it's like some of them are memories of different places. And, you know, some of them feel like they are maps because some of them are. So how I saw them as is like I used typical sayings that I've heard in Black communities, and I thought about what that would look like, and it all depends on what song I'm listening to, so it's all intuitive, you know. The coloring is intuitive as well, so yeah, it's just something with whatever, you know, like an example is get up and cut this grass. Now, get up and cut the grass is a saying that my father would say every Saturday. Like every Saturday, get my brother up. He's like, get up. It's time to get up. Cut this grass. Just get dressed. Do it. And, you know, and so, you know, those lines are very much of the pattern of how you would, you know, go with a lawnmower back and forth. You know, in
mowing,
the yard.
Yeah,
mowing the grass. Mm-hmm.
I love your titles. They're so autobiographical. Everything is like really from your life.
Yes, everything is. Everything is.
And the drawings, are they quite like, do you go into the meditative state making those? Are they, do you kind of like go trance-like, or are they
the paintings
something you really consider?
Drawings.
The painting, sorry, the works on paper, the paintings on paper.
It's okay. Yeah, they're meditative, you know, meditative state as well. You know, I don't really think about it. You know, I actually have a, you know, like a playlist for everything, every, you know, works that I do. I have an actual playlist of songs that kind of help
work
me.
Each work has its own playlist.
Yeah.
Its own mixtape. You give a mixtape. You make a mixtape for each kind of
piece. I do.
What, for each series or each individual work?
It varies between series and individual works, you know?
Wow.
Yeah.
And do you repeat the mixtape, or are you like that specific to the identity of that piece or that series?
It's for that, you know, specific piece or series of work. So I don't repeat the songs. I don't.
Oh, we need to see these. So when we see your work, we need to then see the mixtape. There needs to be a correlation between the two.
Is that something you'd want to share though? Or is it like part of your private process?
Well, it is just something that I do. But if people are interested in knowing what I listen to,
yes, 100%. Yes. Yeah, we'll have to talk to Tommaso to release something to do with that.
That's
yes,
cool.
I love that.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, you should make like a vinyl or a,
Or a Spotify playlist that we can all connect to, while we're seeing the show.
Yeah, that would be, actually, that's a really good idea.
Right. You can have that. Let's do that.
Yeah.
So we ask every guest that comes on two very important questions. The first one is, if you could do an art heist, if you could legally steal any artwork in the world for yourself, what would it be and why?
Oh, man. I would say anything that is made by Jan van Eyck.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
You know, like how how colors are selected, you know, and just the form and the placement of form, but really how colors are layered. I love that. I just love anything from his work, but also Hieronymus Bosch, Earthly Delight.
Yes.
Wow.
Love that.
Yes.
Love
yes.
it. Yeah.
That's in Madrid. We know where that is. I know the exact room that's in, so we can go get it.
Easy. They're heavy hitters. They're good ones.
Yeah.
They're very good. Yeah. That's super cool. The other question we ask every guest is, what is your favorite color?
My favorite color is yellow because it's bright.
It features a lot in your paintings as well.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, love yellow.
Is that something you've loved like all your life?
You know, it varied. I changed my colors from time to time. I don't really stay at one, but you know, yellow is quite sticking right now. Nice. Love yellow, but green is creeping up quite nice, like a nice earthy green. Is good. It's quite satisfying.
Well, that's the lawn you were just talking about, mowing the lawn. That was that's the feature work, the painting that's in your show. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you look to a lot of fresco paintings, a lot of Renaissance panels for ideas as well. Like that's where the gold luster comes from, that's coming into your ceramics. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, we love you, Shawanda. We think you're legit brilliant.
And, thank
you. Yeah. Russell actually sent me your work, and that's how I first discovered it. And the minute I saw it, I felt such a strong pull to the work. Same. And all I wanted to know was everything. Like, I needed to know everything. And I contacted Tommaso straight away, and he was sending me PDFs of all your works, even things that are from the past. I've just been so interested in it, and I don't know why, but I just feel such a strong connection to your work. And I'm so happy that we were able to talk to you this quickly, you know, from the point of discovery to, because maybe I learned about your work a month ago or something. So it's really, really exciting. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
And for everyone listening, we're going to be posting images on our Instagram, which is at Talk Art. And Shawanda, you have your own Instagram, don't you? Which has a very iconic title.
Yeah. It's cyborg_artist. I think that's what it is.
And you're a science fiction fan, right? Fundamentally, you're a big science fiction fan.
Okay. Love science fiction, yeah.
Yes.
So like Star Trek and,
Yeah, Star Trek.
Did you remember that 60s sci-fi movie you was trying to think of?
Oh, yeah. So the brain, yes. I want to say it's the head that wouldn't talk.
The head that wouldn't talk. Okay, wouldn't cool.
I think that's what it's called,
we'll have to check that out.
And it's very feminist, it's brilliant. I love it.
Or is it the head that wouldn't die?
Wouldn't die. Thank you. Yes. Yeah.
It couldn't talk.
Wouldn't die.
It could talk, we wanted it to die because it was talking too much.
Wouldn't die.
I've got it wrong completely. It's the brain that wouldn't die.
The brain that wouldn't die. So we both just
1962. Horror sci-fi. I just looked it up now to actually get it correct.
The brain that wouldn't die.
I was trying to process it in my own head. I remember it. The brain that wouldn't die. Now that is cool.
Mm-hmm. Right, everybody check that out. Definitely.
Well, thank you everyone
for listening. We'll be back soon. Yeah, thank you, Shawanda. You're amazing. Soon. Everyone should check out your show and follow you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks so much. All right. See you very soon. Lots of love.
Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diament and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.